This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. This is the second part of my chat with Thomas, who worked in a secret East German radio monitoring base. Part 1 is episode 312. He describes how a Bricksmith or other military liaison mission vehicle had once got onto the base and what the East German army was told about the military liaison mission capabilities. When his officers weren't around, he and his comrades listened to Western radio and watched Western TV. Gorbachev is now in power and liberalisation has started in the Soviet Union, and the East German government worries about contamination. Thomas describes his participation in the protests in Dresden and is totally shocked by police brutality against the citizens of East Germany. We talk about the opening of the wall and the decline of East German army discipline as the country starts to implode in the march to reunification. We also hear some surprising details about the contents of his Stasi file. I'm delighted to welcome Thomas back to our Cold War conversation.
At least once in the half year, we were told how to react in case of a so-called MLM alarm, military liaison mission alarm.
The military liaison missions were British, American, and French units that were allowed by a treaty signed straight after World War II to patrol East Germany to minimise tensions between the Western Allies and the Soviet forces. We have a number of episodes about the military liaison missions, so do check out the link in the episode information.
That was part of the regular training, and we took it really seriously. So, what happens if we get this alarm? Or when is the time we get this so-called MLM alarm? What shall we do? So we got this alarm when the MLM guys approached, or they left the highway from Erfurt down to the south. I mean, there were no highway at that time, so you had to go over the pass in Oberhof. And I guess many kilometers before, Stasi had them on the radar. And so that means we got this message. And then we were all, the company was alerted. Okay, there's an MLM alarm. Immediately shut down the windows. Immediately roll down the curtains, only whispering until the alarm is released. And then the ones who are not on duty, I mean, the sentries were enforced. We only had one sentry at the gate. But we had these little bunkers over the hill. So the bunkers were stuffed with additional sentries, and they were equipped with blankets and newspapers. Because that was clear, we were told, if you come across such an MLM car, you can stop him, but you can just cover his windshield or his windows, either with blankets or with newspapers, that they can't move around anymore. And then immediately to inform the officer of duty, and the officer of duty would have informed the Russians to come over. So this was really a big deal, but to be honest, without knowing anything about the background, why they are here, why we are afraid of coming to our object. So really strange if I think about, I mean, yeah, you have this allies, that you have the British, you have the Americans, you have French, they are the enemies, and they can come somehow close to our object, which they are forbidden. And I remember they were sort of threatening us also with this military liaison mission story. So there was one tale, and I don't know if it is really true or if it's just a fairy tale, but there was a rumor ongoing 2-3 years before I came to that outpost. I told you about the large band before the gate, huh? And all the supply trucks when they brought the bread and so on, they just beeped the horn, and the sentry came and just opened the gate, and then they came in. So pretty relaxed. Huh? And someday they also heard the horn beeping, thought it's a supply truck, and then poof, a G wagon or Jeep at that time, we didn't know what the G wagon is, went in on the there was an open place between the barracks and the service building, went in, turned, and immediately got out before the sentry was even able to realize what happened and closing the gate. Huh? And I mean, they were telling this story many times. This is the capability. They are so rude. They are overruling. They are not respecting any laws, any posts, and so on. But what a story, huh? We were told, listen, they have a really high tech. Their cars, they are able to turn at the spot because they have a four-wheel steering. They can steer each wheel individually. So that means you have to block them from each side, because otherwise they just turn on the spot and then escape. And actually what I learned later on, I mean, that was not true. That was fake news. But yeah, they had double fuel tanks and fortified ground clearance and these sort of fancy light switchings. And so, I mean, they were well equipped, but this was what we were told. They really have high-tech cars, and they have these long-range microphones. They have thermal vision imaging. They even can listen how you click your keyboard, or they. That's why we had to shut down the curtains. They have this powerful binoculars that they even can watch what you are writing down. So and. That's why we had to whisper, because they have these long range microphones. And then another rumor was going, but I'm pretty sure that was one to really threaten us, to make us aware what could happen. Because one day we were told, listen, we got a picture from one of our soldiers that was stopped by an American Jeep. And the picture was showing that he pointed on his watch or was talking to them. And you see, they are trapping you. They pretend what's the time? You go there, you just say the time, and then they send you a picture. So never talk to any of these guys, because they are the devils. They will blame you. They send these photos. To your commander, and then you're messed up.
Well, the Bricksmith guys have always said that the NVA were the most disciplined, certainly versus the Soviets, that they rarely got any engagement or any easy way in to an NVA position.
Yeah, because we were really, really were alerted and trained to be cautious. Huh? But the funny thing is, later on, I found out that there's a Stasi file mediatheque from Suhl, and there was an article about the activities of them. Because not sure, I don't have these detailed maps, but I guess our area, our hill, and also Suhl, they were permanently restricted area. So, and in that mediatheque, I really found a picture supposedly taken outside from the fence by some of the Bricksmiths or USML guys, which is really fascinating. Huh? Because then I realized, yeah, they were really there. They were lying in the underwood, and really were watching us. And But we never have seen them. I mean, they got a good camouflage. but it would be fun, really, if some of these guys who may listen to your podcast, if we can get in touch to hear the other side. I mean,
yeah, we'll put the word out, certainly through the podcast. But were you told why these military liaison missions were allowed to drive around East Germany?
Not at all. We had no clue, and surprisingly, we never asked. Yeah, because at that time, I mean, the Russians were there. Okay, the Americans were also there. But why are Americans going around in East Germany? We didn't question that. I mean, this was far beyond our imagination. What is the reason? And that they are not just going to us. I mean, they are going around through whole Germany, East Germany. And to be honest, I never have seen of these, or I don't remember. So we were never told what is the background. And of course, never told that the Russians do the same. No?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. I mean, I guess it's the ideal bogeyman to make sure that you're on your toes as far as security. They're almost portraying the military liaison missions as having supernatural powers to listen in. If you speak to, you know, a lot of NATO troops, there was a decent likelihood the Soviets were going to come over the border and invade West Germany. Did you ever believe that NATO would try and invade East Germany? Because presumably that was the picture that was painted to you.
Correct. Absolutely. I mean, of course. I mean, the NATO, that was the enemy. And the enemy wants to destroy us. The enemy wants to rule, yeah, to win against socialism, to destroy us. And we knew that we had an equilibrium because between the nuclear power nations, but of course the West German army, they are the aggressors, and we are just the defenders. So we are a defensive force. Of course, we have also tanks to defend ourselves, but we are not an aggressor force. Of course not. Huh? And so that's what we learned. To be honest, at that time, I mean, it was Cold War. And it really was cold, but it was not as cold as it might be now, unfortunately. So we were living in this equilibrium. And at the end of the day, we were saying to each other among us, yeah, if it comes to a conflict, if it comes to a war, it will be amongst between the Russians and the Americans. Because until we get into our bloody stupid uniforms and old-fashioned gear, and until the West Germans get back from the 9-to-5 jobs into the barracks, the Russians and the Americans, they already made it out somehow. So that was our thinking, that we are not getting involved.
So that was you talking amongst the friends that you could trust amongst you. I mean, you must have been a bit nervous about talking about those sort of subjects amongst other people.
At a certain point, of course, I mean, you're living together. You're living together 24/7. You're living together in a comradeship. I mean, and you lose the fear. You lose the sense that you were trained to have. Because, I mean, you are there, you are drinking together, you are partying together, you are on duty together, you are all the time you are together. And then, you cannot hide yourself. You speak openly and so on. And And then I remember also a good comrade of mine, he told me, listen, watch out. I suspect that your roommate or I don't know if it was a room. Yeah. Anyhow, he might be one of a Stasi informant. And I said, nah, come on. No way. I mean, we had these good talks when we are on duty during night shift. I mean, what to do during night shift? You talk a lot. You drink coffee. You drink tea. You talk a lot. And I said, no, that can't be true. And then he said, yeah, did you realize when he goes out, pretty unusual times, that he's out of the station, going somewhere. And I said, yeah, come on, yeah, maybe he has a girlfriend. Well, I don't know. So, and yeah, there were rumors that there were informants. I mean, no surprise, but at that time we didn't have any clue what is an informant. That so many East Germans were unofficial informant of the Stasi. We had no clue. We had these rumors. The Stasi is listening to you. The Stasi is watching you. I mean, I remember we had one phone because we were privileged to have a phone at home, but we had to share this phone with another family which lived four floors above us. And then when we picked up the phone, we had this clicking noise. And then we were joking, someone is listening to us. And in fact, I guess they also did. So there were always rumors that the Stasi is there, but we never imagined the extent, which later was revealed, to what extent they made the violence of their own people. No clue at that time.
If the Bundeswehr had crossed the border and were coming up the hill, I mean, did you talk amongst your, you know, would you just put your hands up or would you actually put up a fight?
No, that's really a tricky question. And I don't really remember if we really talked about that, but it was always a fear that we are getting personally involved in a conflict where we have to shoot, where we have to use our weapons. I don't know if we really talked about, but knowing that you have to shoot to guys who speak the same language, I mean, being foreigners for us at that time, and really tricky question if the Germans would have shot the Germans. And I guess for some extent, yes, because, you know, Germans and orders. But really hard question, and fortunately it never happened. Fortunately, the history proved completely different. But tough question.
You still considered NATO as the enemy, but more so the British, the Americans, and the French, rather than the West.
The British and the Americans. Yeah. And we didn't to be honest, we didn't differentiate between the British and the Americans, because in the East German slogan, they were always called as the Anglo-Americans. The Anglo-Americans bombed Dresden to the ground. The Anglo-Americans, the Anglo-American imperialists, blah, blah, blah. So they were always put together.
You mentioned earlier about listening to Western radio. Did you watch any Western TV? Because presumably you got a really good signal where you were.
Yes. And as I said, I mean, as a kid, I only watched West television when we visited some relatives in Leipzig. I was raised up in a little town near Dresden. The town is called Pirna. I guess you heard about that, the well-known Tal der Ahnungslosen, the Valley of the Clueless. I mean, actually, we were not so clueless, but at least we didn't receive any Western TV stations or radio stations. So I was completely fascinated by the advertisement. The advertisement break was the most fascinating. thing to watch. And to be honest, the first time where I regularly watched Western television was in the army, because in the service floor, on the service floor where we were on duty, there was a little camping TV set, a Russian TV set, and they somehow mocked it. And you just need a little antenna, and then you got the West TV channels where we watched Formula One, the music show, and so on. But only on weekend. Huh? On weekend we were on by our own. No officers were there, also depended. Huh? There was one officer who also watched with us, but for other officers, you wouldn't do that. So it really depended a little bit. But if we were among us. Yeah, we switched on the TV.
Well, Formula One, the music show, not Formula One motor racing.
No. The Formula One, that was the name of the music show. And to be honest, this was the first time when I saw videos for the music. So far, I just listened to the music via shortwave or via cassette player and so on. But that was the first time when I also saw that the artists performing. I saw them. I never saw them before. I just always had the voice.
And so did you see, like, the video of Nina and 99 Red Balloons?
Yeah. And so that was not the big deal. And I was listening to another podcast, what music was being played in the discos. Huh? And what I remember... we had all the Western music. Of course, they also played some East German songs, but the majority was Western. And I remember the last weekend before we got drafted, the song "I'm in the Army Now" was in the charts, and this was played in the disco. And you can imagine, knowing in 2 days we are off. So we were dancing to that song. Just reminds me at the moment.
So what was your favorite Western band then? That you know that when that video came on, that was the one that you always enjoyed.
My favorite Western band? Hard to say. I'm more a soft music lover. Either ABBA, for instance. I liked ABBA, but we also danced a lot for Depeche Mode. Depeche Mode was a big deal at the time.
They were huge in East Germany.
Big deal. And I had a lot of freedoms during my teenagerhood, but the only freedom that I didn't have was to have long hairs and crazy clothes. So I liked Depeche Mode, but I never dressed up like them. I mean. Almost everybody was dressed up like that. So I never did. But funny enough, I got tickets now for June. Depeche Mode playing in Leipzig. The first time that I go to a concert for them.
Oh, brilliant. That's great. That's really nice to hear that. So you're there as East Germany starts to rebel. You know, the population is the unrest starts. Do you have any sense of that where you are?
Yeah, actually, I mean, it started a little bit earlier with Gorbachev. Huh? Glasnost and Perestroika. What we heard that the new guy and but of course it was completely denied by our government. It was The famous saying was, if your neighbor is renovating his house, you don't need to renovate your house because your house is still in good shape. So that was the excuse not to follow the Soviet way, because we were always needed to follow the Soviet way, but at that time, no way. So then we decided, we can follow our own East German way. So it started with Glasnost and Perestroika. And I remember when we were there in 87, that you were able to buy in the Soviet Union, in Russia. And I was there in summer, but I also was in Moscow in winter with a school class. So we went to Moscow also and queued up in the Lenin Mausoleum and so on. And they already had some Western stuff, some not really black market, so semi-official. And then we had this pretty well-known Reader's Digest magazine, Sputnik. I guess you heard about that. I mean, Sputnik was Reader's Digest from Soviet Union, nothing special. But then with Glasnost, it changed. Yeah, you got this really exciting articles about Stalin, Stalin's sons, and whatever. So, and then from out of the sudden, from one day to another, they prohibited the Sputnik, and then everybody was upset. I mean, what is this? I mean, from our Soviet friends, from our Soviet brothers, we are not even allowed to read their magazines. So this really hit hard. Huh? And then, I mean, for the rest, where I was stationed, we didn't really got much. And to a certain point, this was an underground movement, huh? Especially focused on Berlin and, of course, Leipzig, huh? with these Mondays demonstration. But we didn't heard about that. And we weren't aware. I mean, we were realizing, okay, something is growing. Huh? And I mean, it really speeded up in 89. Huh? In 89, when you got the refugees going to the embassies, when Hungary opened the border, I mean, that was the culmination point, or the ignition point. And then it went so quickly. And I remember I was there. I was there in summer in Hungary. So I had a vacation. And fortunately, I got the visa, so I was allowed. So I went to my grandparents. I saw the people. Because the where my grandparents lived, the West German embassy was pretty close. I mean, it was in the public, so I saw the people there, and I never thought, of course, joining them because it was no option at that time. And then I thought, boy, that's a lot of people, a lot of normal people, because they were described as the asocial rowdies, whatever. The only these ones are escaping, but these were the normal people. And you realize, oh, a friend at home, he's not there anymore. He's gone. Huh? He's somewhere. He just escaped. And that was tricky time. And then I remember coming close to October, the 40th anniversary of GDR, and then there were rumors that something. Let me put that in the time frame. Until the 7th, everything was okay. But later on, we were really afraid that we were forced to settle up on the truck, because we trained on weapons, but we never got sharp munition. But that we really were afraid. Huh? But that's a longer story. Huh? What was going around these days in 80, especially in 89.
So you were fearful that you might be called to put down some of these demonstrations?
Yes. That was the big fear. But before, of course, we didn't know about demonstrations. I mean, when these demonstrations were growing, were evolved in 89, these were small demonstrations. And the big outbreak happened on the 7th of October during this 40th anniversary, and which was for the GDR a big deal. 40th anniversary, Gorbachev was coming, and so on. Actually, that's another story. I was scheduled to go on holiday on the 4th or 5th of October, and a friend of mine he went one day earlier, but he arrived exactly on the date when the refugees from the Prague embassy they were released. Maybe you remember when the West German foreign minister stood on the balcony on the West German embassy in Prague and announcing that they negotiated that the people are freed and are allowed to go to West Germany. But and then our stupid government at that time, they insisted that the trains have to go via Dresden, going through the GDR and then going out to Bavaria. So, and there were quite a big rally because the people were waiting these trains in Dresden at the train station, and then there were some fightings between the police and the demonstration people, and the station was partly destroyed, burned police cars, and so on. Big deal. And at that day, my friend who lived in Dresden, he went back, and then he gave me a call. I mean, we had one telephone at the entrance hall, and telephone was ringing. Thomas, it's for you. And then my friend told me, listen, you're going tomorrow. Don't go in uniform. They will lynch you. Something has happened. People are upset. If they see you in uniform, don't go. Don't make it. So, and then good to know, because usually then I went in uniform because you had this military ticket. So I put my uniform in my bag and went in civilian. I arrived on the 5th or 6th in Dresden. I saw this damaged train station, so I went home. I met next day. I met with a friend of mine. And then we went on the 7th October. He said, okay, there will be a demonstration in Dresden. I heard that. Shall we go? I said, yes. And then we went to Dresden. And if you step out of the train station, there's a big boulevard. So people were gathering there. We were joining them. People were waving flags and strange atmosphere, because at that moment you couldn't realize, was this in the official demonstration or is this an unofficial demonstration? What is it? And then minutes later you realize, okay, there's a one guard or one row of police coming up. And police in equipment I never have seen. I never knew that the East German Volkspolizei had shields, had beat sticks, had helmets. We never have seen something like that. So they were the first one. The second one were these paramilitary workers troops, Kampftruppen. And the third one, I don't remember, but there were quite a lot of people in civilian behind these two rows. So, and then people were singing the International, were shouting freedom or what democracy, whatever. So, and then it really started. Some of the civilian they came into the crowd, they grabbed people, they truck people out to these two rows of forces, and put them on the trucks. People were crying. What an atmosphere! And then I really got so much afraid of, because I knew I'm here as a soldier. I don't have a civilian ID. I only have my military ID. If they catch me up here. And it was escalating. Huh? More and more people were being arrested, taken out of the crowd, and then I really was panicking. And then if I end up in a prison, I will end up in a military prison for quite a long time. And then I was I was looking around, and then I found a gap, a small gap, and then I was running like a rabbit to escape out of this pocket. Huh? And because this pocket got closer and closer, and then the policemen they draw with their beat sticks to the shield in strange rhythm. So it's, and yeah, and then I was running, and then I was gone. Huh? And totally shocked what I saw, totally shocked what I experienced, totally shocked how the police and how they treated the people and the own people. So completely out of the world. And next day we were with my friend, we were going for a hike, because where I was living is a wonderful landscape, Saxon Switzerland, absolutely fascinating, astonishing rock formations where we used to climb around, hiking, a lot of hiking trails in around this Elbe River, beautiful landscape. So we were going out into the wild towards the Czech border. And because the Czech border was always an open border, no border guards at all. We never have seen border guards. And we were walking there, and out of the sudden, border guards stepped out of the underwood. What are you doing here? Yeah, we were just hiking like always. Yeah, you're not allowed to. The border will be closed. And not sure if the border was closed one day before at that moment. Anyhow, so they sent us back. It didn't ask too many questions. But then you realize, oops, I'm not even allowed to the only one country where we were still allowed to go freely, not even to Czechoslovakia. What a nightmare. And then I spent a couple of days with my friends at home, with my parents and so on. And and then I came back to the barracks, and then I talked to a friend of mine who lived in Berlin, who was at the same time in Berlin, and who also experienced this demonstration, this arresting, and we were still under shock. And then we thought, shit, we need to do something. And then we wrote down what we have seen, how we were shocked, because I mean, you need to write off from your soul something. And then we were putting we signed it with our names, and then we were putting it on the whiteboard, on the blackboard in the barracks, huh? And it was there for, I don't know, 1 hour, 2 hours. Next day we were called into a special room. There was a special room where we knew this is the Stasi room. That once a week some Stasi guy, or it was called Abteilung 2000, was coming to do some business. So we were called in. Have you written this? Yes. Do you think that? Yeah, we have seen that, and that's not true. We couldn't believe that. We wanted to express ourselves. Blah blah blah. And at the end, they asked, would you do it again? And then we were so afraid of ending up in this notorious military prison that we say, no, of course we will not do it again. But then we were really of the consequences. But that was already in mid of October, and then things were moving up so quickly, development were so quickly, then this was already history, this was already this was gone, and then the, let's say, the whole development started.
So they didn't follow that up then with you, because events overtook.
Yeah, the events overtook. Maybe the next day or the 2 days later, Honecker was forced to step down. So the stone was rolling, and it was rolling so quickly. I mean, and then. From day to day, new developments, new the press was full. You were able to read articles you never read, discussions and so on. So really exciting. And but we were still a little bit off in our closed isolated area there.
Did the Stasi ever try and get you to be an official informer?
Not the Stasi. I don't remember that they tried, but they tried a couple of times to recruit me or to win me for being a party member. And I mean, at that time, you couldn't be too harsh and tell them, hey, listen, you're just a bunch of idiots. Go away. I don't want to have to do anything with you. So you couldn't do that. You couldn't be so harsh or unpolite. So the best way to say, to be honest, I don't feel mature enough to join your glorious party. So Maybe later, maybe I need to ripe a little bit, but for the moment being, I don't feel ready for that. So, and then that was okay. So, I mean, they tried from time to time, but not really intensively, because I mean, they, in some kind, they were stupid, but not stupid enough. So they felt that was not really my favorite to become a member of the party. So, but it was a pretty good excuse they accepted.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Because you did have a situation where you met a friend from the West in Berlin.
Yes. I mean, that's a story which already started in school. I had a lot of pen friends when I was 13, 14. So, and I mean, having pen friends was nothing special. It was encouraged, but not only to have pen friends, Russian pen friends, Soviet pen friends. So I also had a couple of, I had some Soviet pen friends, and via these Mickey Mouse journals or also Bravo, there was always a corner look or pen friends looking for if you want to become a pen friend, blah blah blah. So I wrote to that, and I got some letters. So I had some pen friends in Japan, in Spain, I don't know, Belgium. Yeah, but anyhow, so. And of course, I mean, at the end of the day, exchanging letters as a teenager's, I mean, that's the same. If you write to in Japanese or Soviet, you put some pictures in, talk about the family, your daily life. But of course, with a Western, it's much more exciting than exchanging with a Soviet. But at the end, yeah, simple stuff. Huh? Exchanging these the Russians are so keen on these pins, snachok in Russian. So exchanging these pins or exchanging bubble gum, paper, inlet papers, and so on. So pretty. Anyhow, so I had this Japanese pen friend, and also some West Germans that I got to know when I was in Budapest just before I was drafted. So I had some contacts. We were exchanging letters. Yeah, but I told them, or somehow I told them, listen, I'm going to be drafted. I'm completely forbidden to have any contacts to any Western. Okay. For the West Germans, they couldn't understand that they could follow, or they could follow what I meant. And to the Japanese guy, I wrote a letter from Hungary saying, okay, I'm being drafted for the next 3 years. It will be hard to keep contact. I will try to write letters, and please send your letters from Japan to Hungary to the postal address of my grandparents. And so we did, not very frequently, but in early 1980, my mother brought a letter from him from Hungary, and then he was writing, okay, with my school class we will be in summertime in West Europe, and there's also a day in West Berlin or a couple of days, and maybe that's a good chance to meet there. Okay, oh wow, yeah, of course, let's meet, but how? For sure not in West Berlin. And how can I deal with that, knowing that I'm I'm absolutely not allowed to have this contact. But of course, I want to see this pen friend where we had contacts for, let's say 5 years. So long story short, I somehow managed to give him the date and the meeting point. And and finally we met, let me check, because we met on the 4th of August, 1880, under the famous Weltzeit, or the world clock, on Alexanderplatz in East Berlin. Wow. I mean, what an emotional moment. You walked there. I mean, there were not so many Japanese around in East Berlin, so I was able to recognize him immediately. And and then you meet that guy that you were writing with for 5-6 years. Huh? And and then we were having a good time in East Berlin. We were strolling around, having a beer, having an ice cream. And maybe we also went to a museum, from, let's say, for 6-7 hours. And and then he said, what a nice day. Let's extend that day. And what I have seen in West Berlin, I mean, there's a funny nightlife. And so, let's go there and go to disco, or let's have a beer or whatever. So, and then I realized, okay, I mean, I spent all the day with him, but must be really rare for a Japanese. I don't know what they were told and where they're going to from West to East Berlin. So, and I said, sorry, I would like, but I can't. So I'm not. So, and anyhow, so I brought him also to Friedrichstraße and then said goodbye. But all the time I had a strange feeling, because I knew I did something really forbidden, really forbidden. And so when we took the tram, we took the tram to one direction, then we changed the tram and went back. And I don't know, just a gut feeling. Well, maybe, I don't know. Anyhow, but no clue at the time. I went back to the barracks, and nothing happened. So, and actually nobody knew that, and nobody asked. I didn't tell anybody. So. And 2015, 26 years later, I thought maybe now it's a good time to ask for possible Stasi files. I didn't know if I had anyone, so I got the Stasi files, and this whole day was in my Stasi file, the whole day. And the whole day we were followed by 22 Stasi guys with 6 cars, and they took pictures, they took audio recordings, which unfortunately they were lost, they were destroyed. I don't know, but it was a pretty shocking moment when I realized, we kept busy 22 of these Stasi guys with 6-7 cars. They were all the cars with license plate numbers were listed on that file, and unbelievable. And then it started rumoring, because the point is, after I met with my Japanese friend, I never heard back from him, never. And to be honest, I never made or tried to get in contact again, because there were so many things after we were released from army. So, and then I realized, they were following us the same day, and I brought him to the border station, and I only can guess what happened to him, because he went through the border, and I'm pretty sure they interrogated him, he took them away, he scared him to death, he were asking what is he doing with a member of the military East German forces, and so on and so on. And I would be so happy to meet him again and to explain myself that I was not the one who was handed him over, supposedly to this border interrogation because I'm pretty sure they did try it hard with him. And I mean that's the story of my Japanese. So I got the code name. They called me the Radio Man. He got the code name. Pretty simple, just the Japanese, because they always use this code name if they are surveillance people. Got an opening file. They asked the Hungarian Stasi about any contacts. Hungarian Stasi never responded. They were not as stringent like the German Stasi. So there were a couple of data in my file.
Be good to speak to him.
Yeah, definitely. I had another experience in East Berlin. I told you we were working pretty closely with the Czech, or I was coordinating also with the Czech army outpost there. And we had a meeting with them. I mean, they were pretty funny, pretty relaxed. And then we, not sure if we got awarded with a trip to East Berlin. Okay, nice. Going with these Czech guys to East Berlin, having a couple of days with good meals, good drinks, and so on. But we were going in uniform, and before we were briefed. Okay, if you go in uniform in East Berlin, be aware there are Allied soldiers around. They are allowed to go to East Berlin. If you get contacted, immediately report it and don't respond to any of the GIs or the British or the French. They are around. They are allowed to go there as tourists. They are in uniform, but don't contact them or don't get in contact. So we were going to this monument, this anti-war monument, Neue Wache, where they had this changing of the guards, and we were standing there watching this. I mean, that's a big spectacle, like in front of the Buckingham Palace, and with this Prussian Stechschritt and so on. And then we were standing there, and then I got something on the shoulder. Then I turned around, a big GI standing, and then he said, "Hey, buddy, how's life?" or something like that. Really, don't speak to me. And no, I didn't say that, but I just moved around and went away. And I mean, what an embarrassing situation. Let's say a brother enemy brother in arms is just saying hello, and you're not even allowed to say back hello. You just have to turn like a wet dog and step away. I mean, what an embarrassing moment. That was, I mean, there are a couple of these moments which stagger up, and then you realize, what the system is this? I mean,
Did you report that? Did you report that?
No. I mean, we were all surrounded. I mean, the officers were next to each other, and this guy picked me, I immediately turned away and went back. And so I didn't report that. I mean, we also had Mr. Czechs. They were really relaxed and good shape and nice to talk with, nice to drink with them and so on. But we also had quite a couple of contacts with the Russians. One day we had a sort of meeting with them, or let's say a casual meeting, a sports event, a football match. Us against them, and they were the ones who were stationed on another hill, so they did the Russian radio reconnaissance. So our counterpart on the Russian side, 50 kilometers from us. So we were meeting them down in the city on a soccer field, and we were there. Some barbecue was planned, and. And actually, I mean, they were really trying hard. They were not allowed too often to go out of the barracks. If they went out, they always went in groups, never as an individual. Huh? And not sure what they were being told, if they don't get a beer at the end, if they don't win, but they really played hard. And at the end, not sure who has won. I mean, they played bad tactics. We had some good football players, but they really tackled. They fouled a lot, and they were really hard. So and we were all in a good mood. We had some bratwurst, some barbecue. We had we got some beer, and compared to them, we felt like being the most free soldiers in the world, huh? Enjoying a beer, enjoying a barbecue, being able to run around and so on. So pretty amazing. Huh? And they didn't talk much. Huh? I mean, they were shy. They just the officers talked. This normal soldiers, they didn't talk. They were among them. So, but so we had this football match, and then we once I was in their barracks, and the barracks. I mean, they had these big sleeping halls, no privacy at all, just some small belongings, all short haircut, and the food that we got was really terrible, this sort of porridge, mud, whatever, strange. I mean, to be there and the conditions, that the toilet rooms with outdoors and so on, so really strange. But and that was the most fascinating things. They had also a whiteboard, and on the whiteboard they had the TV schedule for the Formula One. Coming back to Formula One, but this is the real Formula One. The Formula One broadcasting times on the West German channel. So they were allowed to officially watch the Formula One on ZDF or RD, I don't remember. At least they got from 4 to 5 on the West German channel, because they had this sort of Perestroika Glasnost somehow, and we were totally shocked. I mean, that was unthinkable for us, and that was really fascinating. I mean, complete different world in any case, huh? And
So this was the Formula One motor racing
schedule, right.
They
right.
had on the whiteboard, and they were watching TV. Wow.
I don't know if they even realized that they were watching it completely different, the West German channel. I'm not sure. But it was amazing to see that they were allowed to. That was normal for them.
Thomas, can you remember where you were when you heard about the opening of the war?
Definitely. Because I guess these are some of the moments, most of the German never will forget. The moment when they heard the first time, oopsa, the wall is open. So I do as well. So on the 9th of November, actually, I was sleeping on the evening when the wall was open, because I was preparing for the morning shift on the 10th of November. So I went pretty early to bed and then got up at 3:30. Grabbed some cup of coffee, grabbed a sandwich, and went to the service building. Went there on my desk at 4 in the morning, and then we usually, I mean, it was silence and no operation at all, nothing to listen to, and brewed a cup of coffee, switched on the radio. We usually always had the West German channels in the morning when no officers were there, and then I switched the radio on, and then and the big crowd, and people are partying, and now we are switching to another border station, and then it took me a while. What is going on at 4 in the morning? And then I realized, oops, the wall is open, and then I run to my comrade next door. Did you hear that? And that I also heard, and then. Then we were freaking out. What does it mean? The wall is open. So no clue. So, but we knew that's a big event, a big thing. Something is happening big. And I mean, we were the weeks before, we had all these developments every day, something new, everything, and we realized that history is changing, society is changing, everything is changing. But we never expected, and if you ask any other German or East German, nobody expected that the wall breaks down in one day and so early. Anyhow. So we were really freaking out and then trying to connect to the radio and so on. And yeah, and then usually in the morning at 7, 8, the officers came in. Huh? They were all living in Suhl. They were all also living in the same quarter. And so they were coming in. Of course, they also knew that the wall is open. And then I still remember the picture and will never forget. Each company had a political officer, huh? the red guy, let's say. And I mean, he was a tough guy, also nice guy, kind of. And then he came in white, his face white like a chalk, really white face, and just whispering to himself, "This is the beginning of the end," and not very loudly, but really unbelievable picture in my mind still. This guy saying, "This is the beginning of the end." Yeah, and then we continued work, and of course everybody was excited when the shift ended. We went to the TV and watched and so on. I mean. And of course, no big communication, only radio and what the TV was shown, but that was already enough. But we were far away from any wall, whatever. So, but close to the border. And the 9th of November, it was a Thursday. So, okay. The next day was Friday when the weekend came. So for us, as NCO, soldiers, business as usual, duty as usual, and weekend passed by. And on Monday morning, I still remember that like it was yesterday, the officers came, happy face, really in a good mood, and saying, "You don't know what we did on the weekend." And I say, "Yeah, what did you do?" We went to the West. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I'm not the only one. I also would like to, but unfortunately not allowed. Yeah, nice for you. Yeah, we went there and we got the money and unbelievable. And you know, we were at the Wasserkuppe. And you remember the Wasserkuppe was our opposite, was the Bundeswehr and American reconnaissance hill. Which we were able to see at good weather. So and we said, "What do you mean you were at the Wasserkuppe?" "Yeah, we were around there, and then there were post signs that there is the day of the open door at the Bundeswehr at the Wasserkuppe." We said, "What do you mean day of the open door? what the bullshit are you talking about?" Yeah, and actually, I mean, these guys went more or less undercover because, of course, they were civilian. They joined the people who went into the barracks. They were wandering around this installations, which we knew that they were there. That this is our opposite. These are our enemies. They got a nice bratwurst. They got a beer. They were completely freaking out, telling this, "Listen, we were at the Bundeswehr. I mean, they are our enemies, and they served us with beer and cold beer and good beer and bratwurst." And we couldn't believe that. I mean, that an army makes a day of the open door, and nobody could believe it. But it was, in fact, I mean, this unbelievable story, if I remember that. That's and they were so happy. Favorites. They were so happy. Unbelievable. The guy who came 2 days before, he was so happy. Maybe he got a nice banana, whatever. I don't know. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite stories, that. I mean, a whole, like a load of radio reconnaissance guys from the East having a guided tour around a NATO installation without them knowing.
Yeah, unbelievable, unbelievable.
That's better than any military liaison mission.
Indeed, indeed, effort. Indeed. No, and the point is, I mean, I'm sure they didn't even think to go around the corner and to touch anything. They were just happy about the free bratwurst and the free beer. So simple. Life can be so simple.
Can you remember your first time you actually went over to the West?
Also, definitely, because this also burned into my memories. I mean, we were not allowed as drafted soldiers to go to the West for another 2-3 weeks. So the allowance came end of November. So, and then of course I also applied for vacation, and in the meanwhile, the days before, I contacted this West German friend that I knew since 3 years, which I met in Budapest. So I reactivated this contact somehow. I don't remember via letter, or I got a phone number. I don't know. Anyhow, I reestablished this contact and asked him, listen, I don't know anybody in West Germany, and he was studying in Würzburg, which is not so far away from Suhl, so north of Bavaria, Franconia. And he said, of course, you can come. Yeah, you're welcome. So, okay. I took the train to Würzburg on the 1st of December. And then we scheduled a meeting point, but I said to him, okay, train will arrive, I don't know, 5-6 p.m., but let's meet at 8, that I have some time for me to discover a little bit. So went out of the train station with all the masses, went to the shopping street, and then really got flashed. All the lights, I mean, in December it was already dark, the lights, the Christmas lights, the sound, the colorful shop windows, the doors were open, the goods were sold outside. You had this boards or this selling boards or panels outside. We never have seen selling panels outside on the sidewalk. So, and so completely overwhelming. Then I went, my first shop or my first department store was Woolworths. I mean, brilliant. Woolworths nowadays, it's not, it's not the upper class. Huh? But anyhow, I went to Woolworths completely shocked about the colors, the smell, the noise. What do you think? What was the first item that I bought from my first West money?
I don't know, a Coke, something like that.
A what?
A can of Coke.
No. A deodorant stick. No clue why. I mean, it was just 99 pfennig, so below 1 DM or just 1 DM 20. I don't know. But this was the first thing I just grabbed and to buy at least something, huh? And then I went out on of Woolworths because I mean it's like I don't know and was sitting on the bench and then crying because I mean it was too overwhelming and then I spent a couple of days there with my friend and his friends, and we went out to restaurants, we went to a cinema, and so on. So, and everything, of course, was new, huh? And we went to an Italian restaurant. I mean, at that time, I knew what the macaroni is and the spaghetti. That's all. And then you got the menu, pasta. Never heard that word. What is pasta? Fusellini, tagliatelle, whatever. So, everything, the new, everything new at that moment, and. Yeah, and if I remind myself, I mean, it was like being a monkey, learning many things very quickly. Huh? So, for instance, using a water tap, huh? I mean, we used to have this. Your English-British sort of water taps, one for the cold, one for the hot. In West Germany, they had these mixing batteries, just one tap. But okay, you fix out that the first one, okay, if I turn it left, it gets cold. If I turn it right, it gets hot. The other one works a different way. The other one works with a remote sensor and so on. And then you stand there in the public or public restroom and you're not able to operate the water taps. So anyhow, that was the first trip to the West. Really amazing. Impressive like hell. Unbelievable. And then, everybody got the 100 Deutschmarks as a welcome money, pocket money. And in Bavaria, they gave 40 Deutschmarks on top. So I was a rich, rich kid at that time. With 140 Deutschmarks, just spent 1 mark for the deodorant stick. So I had plenty of money. And I went there with my uniform in my duffel bag. I had my uniform with me, carrying it through Bavaria, and then hitchhiked back to the barracks. So hitchhiked.
What was it like back at the barracks? Did things start to relax?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so I was hitchhiking back. Some cars took me. The one gave me 20 euros. I mean, it's edgy. I mean, you feel embarrassed. Of course, I took the money. I was keen on the money. But on the other hand, good. Anyhow, so coming back to the barracks, everything was pretty relaxed. And people were talking openly. The border was open, things were moving quickly, nobody knew in what direction, but quickly we got some visitors at that time. Trucks were coming in, unloading some stuff in boxes, and at that time we as the people, we were already powerful, and then we said, okay, who are these guys? And then we quickly, I mean, within minutes, we founded a so-called soldiers or council. And then we requested these guys who were coming into our objects to gather and to explain what they are doing. Yeah. And then it turned out they were from the Stasi bringing over stuff, whatever, into our secured fenced barracks out of their headquarter, which they were afraid that it will be stormed, and later on it did. I remember this guy shaking in front of us because he really was afraid of us, and then he was explaining, yeah, that this is military stuff and from a special unit and blah blah blah, which we have to bring, which we have to keep away from bad people, blah blah blah, and then we were requesting, okay, but we as this council, we want to have the second key just in case, and they really handed over the second key. So they were so afraid of the people. Amazing times.
So you almost became like self-governing.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, we requested from them, because usually we were called Genosse Soldat, Genosse Unteroffizier, always Genosse, comrade. But comrade is the term for the party members. And then we said, listen, we want to be called Herr Unteroffizier. Herr, we are not comrades of the party. We don't want to hear this word. So please call us Herr. And they did. Amazing times. I mean,
how quickly does the whole sort of job you're doing fall apart? I mean, and I'm just trying to understand, sort of like, you know, is it sort of January time that the whole thing starting to dissolve?
I mean, November, December, business as usual. We did all the same stuff that we did all the months before, also in January. And then there were rumors that that the drafted will be discharged from the army very quickly, maybe very quickly, because I was supposed to leave the army in August. So, and then out of the sudden, it came up, okay, next week on today is Thursday, next week on Tuesday, you are being released. I'm being released. I mean, what? I mean, we were completely excited, but on the other hand, we will miss our relaxed end, let's say, end time in the army. So there are certain traditions in the army if you are in the last months and so on. Anyhow, it went so quickly, and on Thursday they announced it. On Tuesday we got the papers. Here's your ticket back home. Have a good day. That's it. And then we were being discharged and released end of January.
I mean, at that point, did you want East Germany to still exist as a separate state, or were you very much of a view that Germany is one nation and should be reunified?
At the time, I mean, it started in December, right? that more and more German flags without the East German emblem raised up, and that more and more unity calls were being shouted at the demonstration. One country, and so on, unification. But nobody thought about that, huh? And it was out of imagination. The same like the fall of the wall was out of the imagination. The same like collapsing as a system within weeks was out of the imagination after 40 years of putting pressure, holding the pressure. Anyhow, no, at that time, I didn't think. And then, I mean, I was released. Yeah, what to do? The study starts in September. I mean, plenty of time. So, but I need to do something. So I went back to that factory that actually supported me getting the study. And there I worked for a couple of months, and it was a synthetic fabrics, pretty old factory. If you were there, you felt like being before the war in the 20s, 30s, as it was dropping everywhere. I mean, they had some modern corners by us, but I was working in the old spinning department, and boah, really unbelievable. And then it went quickly. You arrived there in the morning, then you had a guy selling the Bild Zeitung, a guy selling bananas, and so on. Then guy selling whatever. I mean, they came in masses, these little traders, and selling something, and first supermarket chains popped up, bookstores, but still with the East German mark. And then you were able to get a can of Coke for, I don't know, 5 marks, 10 marks to the unofficial. And then things developed very quickly. In March, we had the first free elections, and because I remember, another my first election was still in 1989, and it was on a Sunday. Election day was Sunday. That was my first election, and these were these falsified cheated elections in 1989. And then in March we got this first free election, and then soon after it was announced that we will get the currency exchange, and which was a big deal. And then it went step by step. And to be honest, I never was the one who thought, oh, let's do a special way, and let's keep this little GDR, and we can do it by ourselves, and we will try to develop a better socialism because the idea is good, but the way we did it was not the best. I never was that guy. I was happy about what was happening. In my opinion, it was exactly what needs to happen. The both the West German and the East German, they took the time window they had. They negotiated with the Allies. I mean, nobody really was happy. Remember Thatcher? I mean, she was not the one who was really a supporter of a unified Germany. But history proved it, right?
Yeah, well, events overtook a lot of decisions there. How easy did you find it adjusting to life in the new Germany?
I mean, if you are young, you're starting studying. Fortunately, I did a study chemistry. I mean, there's nothing wrong. Chemistry is that the molecules are the same in East and West. So that's good. But when I started in September, still in GDR, we quickly realized they fired a lot of professors, which were connected more than usual to the system. So there was a big movement, and everybody needed to adjust it to itself. I mean, for us, or for me personally, I mean, it was the start of a new life anyhow, being a student. Okay, student being in a complete different country. Yeah. Got some scholarship, and so that for me personally that was not a big deal. But of course for all the older generation, my parents, I mean, I think every East German can tell stories of unemployment, of breaking off the families, of not coping with all these rapid developments. Everything is changing upside down, to the left, to the right. Everything is new. Everything is different, maybe to the better, maybe to the worse. And it's not all about, of course, I mean, being free is a big value, but being free without work, it's hard. And it hit my father, so the factory was closed down in 92, completely, just being not even being sold, just being demolished, huh? and the machineries being sold to China or somewhere. And he got unemployed. I mean, at the time, was 56 or so. He was simply too old. I mean, there were millions of unemployed people looking for some jobs and earn some money. So really tough time for family. And I think I'm not the only one. Almost every East German family can tell the stories of unemployment. And fortunately, my mother realized pretty quickly. So she said, okay, forget about Russian. I had some French in school, so I will refurbish that. So she went on the school bench again for many months, for years, and changed to French language, because, I mean, there were no French teachers at that time, so they were happy to have her. Changed the school to the gymnasium and so on. So had a good job, earned a good money, but the roles were twisted. Huh? And actually, I mean, for my father, it was hard. And I guess for the most of them, being unemployed is hard. You have a history, you had a life, you had a business life, and from one day to another, it's nothing worth. And this feeling just stops when you get retired, because once you're retired, nobody is asking what did you do. You're just a pension. Hard times for the family.
It's people's identity. It's a big part of somebody's identity. It's
of course.
The job that they do.
Yeah.
And when that job goes, it leaves a big hole, not just financially, but I think mentally and
absolutely. Personally. Absolutely. And on top of that, you're being told, you had a job, but all you did, that was rubbish. I mean, we were much better, much more productive. You just were having nothing. I mean, you dealt with always with shortages. I mean, what were you able to produce? I mean, you're not competitive and so on. No wonder why everything collapsed. And I mean, if you get put in that light, I mean, it's hard.
Yeah, you've devoted your whole life to that job, and you're now told, well, that was what you were doing was rubbish, useless.
But for me personally, I mean, all doors were open. I enjoyed traveling. I remember the D-Mark came 1 or 2 weeks later. I bought an Interrail ticket, and with the friend from the army, we got on the train and we went through whole West Europe. And I remember that. I mean, the first city was Amsterdam, then Brussels, and then we took the ferry to England, to London. And then every day, you had your question. I mean, this is Big Ben. I know we had the Big Ben on the school book of the seventh class, and at that time, Big Ben was like the moon. And now I'm in front of the Big Ben. I can touch it. And it's exactly looking like in my school book. And I'm here. I mean, crazy moments every day. And crossing these borders with our new fancy light blue GDR passport. Pretty exciting. Because, I mean, they never have seen a BB. We came from France to Italy. Yeah. And the border guard said, what is this? What country? Never heard that. Eh? What is this?
What would you say is your fondest memory of East Germany?
Good question. I mean, I didn't have a bad life. I had a good family. Or I have a good family. I have a nice brother. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to answer, but the happiest moments were always vacations. Huh? I mean, they were adventurous. We were touring through to Bulgaria with the Lada, with a camping trailer in the back, and everywhere. Strange to say that the moments when you are outside, but I don't want to complain too much. If I would ask you what are your happiest moments in the UK, I don't know what's your answer after.
It would probably be similar. It would probably be similar. To be honest, I think it's family memories and things like that, because we become nostalgic about those times.
Indeed.
Because they were, I don't know, perhaps safer times or happy memories. But it's a question I just like to ask people, because I'm talking about, with my memories, the country is still there, but with your memories, that nation is no longer there. Obviously, the physical places are.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the nation is there, yeah, but the country is gone. And not only the country is gone, but many places of my childhood. My school is not there. My kindergarten is not there. Everything either was demolished or put away. You have some stuff, some chocolates which still are being produced, but there are few things that really remained, and it's really strange that a big part doesn't exist anymore. The buildings are not there. Everything is gone, huh? And I mean, for me, I'm not too mentally sick about that, but for many people, I mean, if you erase your whole life, or not the whole life, but part of the life, that you do not even have places where you can go. Okay, this was my school, and this is how it looks now. Or here, this is the factory where I used to work, and it's still producing. That's strange. Huh? Whole country just is gone, no?
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.